Our podcast today is produced at St. John's Lutheran Church in Salisbury, North Carolina, where we see the church as an important venue for conversations that matter, a place where we can and should engage in good, faithful, sometimes hard conversations about issues and events that need our attention. For more conversations like these, visit our website, stjohns-salisbury.org, or follow this podcast on your preferred platform. Guys, are you ready in the back? When you feel set up, we'll go.
I'm ready.
All right. I'll give 5 seconds and then we'll start. Hey, this is Rhodes Woolley, and welcome to our conversation with folks who have made a deep impact on our community. Today, I'm joined by Marvin Moore, principal of Eisenberg Elementary School in Salisbury since 2012. Marvin's a phenomenal principal and one of my favorite people in town, but many of you are more familiar with his work elsewhere, specifically on the basketball court at Catawba College, where he played basketball from 95 to 99. While he was there, he was a, let's see if I can get all this right, all-conference, all-American, conference athlete of the year, Catawba College athlete of the year. You were inducted into the Conference Hall of Fame, named a distinguished alumni of Catawba College. He's been a finalist for the Principal of the Year and was chosen to be the community principal for all of the city's schools. I guess I could go on and on, Marvin. You've got a trophy case full of awards. So let me ask you this, your first question. What are you proudest of and why?
So first of all, it never gets old when people read off that kind of stuff. I feel like I'm really old when you start talking about those things, but the thing I'm most proud of, and I say this to most people, the fact that I graduated from college in 4 years. I was never the best student in school. It was, I couldn't do it. I just didn't feel motivated to do so. I played sports and I did academics, but the only reason why I did academics the way I did was because of sports. My mom would not let me play if my grades weren't up to par. And it just so happened that my seventh grade year, I broke my thumb playing football. And before basketball season started, I was out playing again, like still playing with the cast on and really not focusing on my schoolwork. And I remember like it was yesterday, one of my good friends, still to this day, we were on our way home. And he said, man, basketball practice is tomorrow. And you're supposed to get your cast off today. I was like, yeah, man, I'm ready. So I went to get the cast off. And we had report cards. I never forget it, like it was, and he had almost all D's on his report card. And I had like C's and a couple of D's. And he was like, oh, you should be straight. And I said, man, my mom is not gonna let me play. He was like, what? No way, you got some C's and you got like two D's. I said, man, my mom ain't going for that. So when I went home and I showed her my report card, she said, oh, you may as well keep that cast on, because whether it comes off or not, you're not playing. And she meant that thing. So the next day I went to school, I talked to the coach, and it was Coach Long, who's a middle school coach. I said, Coach Long, my mom is not gonna let me play. He was like, well, I'll talk to her. I'll take her to the school. I'll take you home. So he took me home, came to the house, and she said, why weren't you on the bus? I said, well, Coach Long wanted to bring me home because he wanted to talk to you. And she met him at the door. She said, my son will not be used. He will not be used for sporting purposes. He's a great student. And he's got to graduate from high school, and I want him to go to college. And if you're coming to me asking me today to let him play basketball with two D's on his report cards, and you know he's an AB student, then I don't understand why would you come here? Like, you're trying to use him, and you know he's not working to his potential. So I would ask that you leave and never come back. I was in the seventh grade. I never remember her saying that to him, and I was so upset, more embarrassed to him because she had to speak to him that way. But now that I'm older, I realized why she did that. She knew that I couldn't do it without it. So, and where I came from, I was in an impoverished area, but it really wasn't, we didn't realize how poor we were, but it wasn't like a super violent area. But she was really along the lines, she would always say to me, you are who you are, and you, and because of who you are, you can go where you wanna go, but you gotta put in the work. And she meant that, I mean, wholeheartedly. Like, she would always say, you're not your situation. So that made me understand it. But to actually graduate from Catawba College in 4 years with a degree, and I had a 3.0 when I graduated, I thought that was really a huge deal for me. I graduated on time, 4.30 GPA, and I mean the rest is history when it comes to that. And then I went back and got a master's, and was working on my doctorate degree. Still may go back and finish it. So I was never the best student, but going to college and getting a degree really changed the landscape of my life.
Marvin, you grew up in Ahoskie, a small farming community in eastern North Carolina, population 5,000. Pretty typical town in eastern North Carolina, loaded with tobacco and cotton fields. But would you consider your growing up years typical or atypical?
I think my growing up years were typical in an atypical household, right? So we had the same thing everybody else had. So, and when you are in a situation where most of the people don't have very thriving job markets that are around you, you tend to do what everybody else do. Is you go to church, you respect your elders, you work as hard as you possibly can, and then you try to do what you want to do as it pertains to what your hopes and dreams are. Sports were huge around us. So football was life. And then basketball was life for those guys that really did okay at football, but basketball was next. So it was a football town. But my mother raised us, my mother's family and my father's family formed a different relationship. Like if you were to meet my mother and my father's family, you would think they were the same people because it was just a small town and most people that grew up together, the family's integrated so well. So when people meet me now, they can't tell my cousins from my mother's side or my cousins from my father's side because we just really are so good about getting together. My mom and my father, which is typical in my area, a lot of people got divorces because a lot of times the men weren't doing right and the women raised the kids. So my mom never taught me to hate my dad. As a matter of fact, before he passed away, I didn't even know he was sick. And I was in college, as a matter of fact, and she would always tell me, you need to go spend some time with your daddy. And I'm like, Mom, what you mean? Like, he left us. Like, and she would say, no matter what, he's your daddy. You need to go in there and spend some time with him. You never know. And we made amends. But my mother was the atypical part of my situation that was very typical. Like, I had a very typical upbringing from the social parts of it, the community part of it. But my mother was the difference. Like, she was the one that made it all go. Like, she saw something very different in us, and she would always tell us, you're not your situation. So you got to think different. You got to be different. And she would, even if it means you're going to be different. And I would say to all, they treat me different, Mom. They treat me so different. And she would say, they're supposed to, you are. I say, that makes no sense. All of my other friends can do this. You're going to be different because you are. You just need to know that and accept that. You're going to be different. Like, they're going to go out and hang out all night. You cannot do that. You're going to church on Friday nights. Have all-night prayer. Spend the night in church on Friday nights as a high school student. I was like, this is middle and high school. You in all-night prayer on Friday nights. I was like, Mom, this is ridiculous. You setting us up to be joked on all weekend, all Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Like, this is ridiculous. So, but she said, you're different, and you need to act that way and accept it. So, and when she said, you'll reap the benefits of what I'm giving you now. And she was courageous enough to not only say that, but to stand by her words. And she didn't mince words at all when it came to her kids. Like, you're going to do it this way, and that's it. So, but yeah, it was a very typical situation as far as where I grew up. Everybody did it the same way, but it was very atypical when it came to her. Like, she made it very different and made us see ourselves very different. So perspective is everything. And she taught us that at a very early age.
That's a great response. I love that response, especially on Mother's Day weekend. We just set you up. We're recording this on Mother's Day weekend, and so that's a great response about your mama. You know, you've probably already answered this question, but I'm going to go ahead and ask it just to make sure. As you think about your growing up, is there that one person who impacted you more than any other?
Yeah, it's my mom. Like, she was different. Like, my mom never, that I can remember, ever worked a full-time job. She worked a lot of part-time jobs. Like, she worked a lot of part-time jobs, but education was huge to her. She was always reading a book, reading the Bible. Like, you could grab her Bible and there was more highlights in it than a person just doing a dissertation on a project. Like, she really was about words and about how to project yourself and to do these things. Like, to her, like, vocabulary was a great equalizer. So she wanted you to know that you don't have to speak the way everybody else speaks. Where I'm from, like, there's not a lot of guys that went to college. So, and where I'm from, there's not a lot of, it's not a lot of diversity in the area that I lived in. So it was the black people on this side of the railroad tracks, the white people on the other side of the railroad tracks. And if you spoke with any form of vocabulary enhancement or anything that was more than two or three syllables on a word, oh, you're talking white. Like, why you talk like that? Why you speak like that? So a lot of times we would have to dumb down what we knew in order to just fit in with our group. And that wasn't to say they were bad people. It's just my mom made us understand that your vocabulary, people can hide things from you with words. So you need to know what they're saying. So get in here and do that. So not only with that, but the way you treat people. Like, she was very serious about, like, you should never see yourself doing well and then the people beside you not doing well and you're okay with that. So find out ways you can help people. I remember like in our neighborhood, like we never had a lot of money, food, but we was a really good community. A real, real good community. And most of us grew up doing and seeing the same things and we looked out for each other a lot of times. So I remember going house to house, borrowing sugar and barring this, barring that, catching a ride with somebody over here, doing those things. And my mom was always that person that would make us understand, like, when we have it, it's not just us that needs to have it, the people that's in our neighborhood, because you never know when you're going to need somebody else. And she was huge in that way. She just really was amazing. And when I can't say enough things about my mom, you know, like, when we talk about education and what we do, I graduated from Catawba, which is a private school. Never even heard of it. Matter of fact, I couldn't even pronounce the name. It was Catawba for 4 years when I go back home in the summer, right? It was Catawba when I went back home to my friends, right? And my mom was so driven. She worked a part-time job and used to catch rides to work and went back, and she was working actually at the community college as a receptionist. She ended up getting like three or four different associate degrees while she was there, working there part-time. And then she ended up, when I graduated from Catawba, I told her, I said, Mama, I'm your baby, right? So now you don't have to do anything. You can just go and do whatever you want at this point. She went back and got her four-year degree in 2 years, right? So, and now her landscape of her life has changed. And it made me appreciate her that much more, because when she did it, it let me know that she put her whole life on hold for us. Like, she was more than capable of going to college, but she couldn't do it with three kids and then also helping to raise four or five other of my cousins who were staying at our house intermediately throughout whatever time in our lifespan. So, and then not only that, she do that, Pastor Rose, you know what else she did? My sister graduated from one of the colleges that's online, I'll think of it in just a minute. But my sister graduated and got her bachelor's degree, right? I didn't even know my mom was working on her master's. We was at my sister's graduation for her bachelor's degree. And my mom, that day, told my sister congratulations, and then told her, she said, guess what else happened? I said, what's going on, Mom? She said, I just graduated with my master's. I was like, what? She was like, I just graduated this weekend, I turned my last paper and I'm done. Master's degree. So she has a master's degree and she went back and got that at 50. That's crazy, right? So to go 40 years old, you go back and get your bachelor's and then go back and get your master's at 50 and you're a single parent doing it all by yourself. Like, she's an amazing lady, man. I can't say enough things about who she is and what she's done. So I tell people all the time, if she can do it, I have no excuse as to why I can't do it. No excuse.
That's great. Yeah, those are great stories. I love your passion for your mom. She's a living stone, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That's awesome. I love hearing that. Well, listen, you could talk a lot about your growing up years, but I do want to ask one more question about it, because I know there were multiple events that impacted you greatly, but one in particular As a kid, you witnessed a KKK rally in your community, right? Pretty impactful, pretty dramatic. What's, as you think back, like even when I just mentioned it, is there that one image, that sort of Kodak moment or that image that sticks with you as you think back on that rally?
Yeah. The thing that really sticks out to me is the time where, like, it was literally a parade. It was really a parade. Like, people stood out to watch this. And the first image I was asking, like, because, you know, when, well, I don't know if you're aware of this, but when you're in the Black community, there are some things that you're told you don't go close to that. Like, that's nothing that you even get yourself close to being involved in. And that's taught to you as a kid. Like, you don't do that. Yeah. This is something that you are to not respect, but to fear. Don't get caught in these situations. And this is why. And I was like maybe 6 or 7 years old, standing out there watching that. And I'm watching just how proud the people looked when they were doing it, as if it was like they were the right to do so and that was right. But I'm told that don't go close to that because you can get hurt by that. So I knew from what I'm being told, this is not right. But the way they're doing it, they seem so proud about what they're doing. And it sends a different kind of message to the kids and everybody else. Like, how is it that they can do that and be that proud of what they're doing, but what they're doing in a lot of situations are hurting me? So it really put a different spin on the perception of being with people who are white growing up. Like, so I had a couple of guys in my neighborhood, like, that would say, he can't be your friend because he's white. He's not to be trusted because of what we were told growing up. And then not only what you're being told, but what you've also seen in this space. And then what makes it even harder is when you meet people and have a chance to have, like, you really want to like this guy, but you know, I can't get that close to you, man. Like, because this is real, right? Mm-hmm. Not even that for the dating purposes of it. Like, you don't cross those lines where I'm from. Back then in 1988, 89, 90, like, no way. Like, that conversation is not even to be had. Like, she can be nice, she can be cute, but she got to stay over there, we got to stay over here. Even with the guys, like, I can't remember going, and some of my friends, like, to this day, I don't remember ever going into their houses. And we played football together from middle school to high school. No, I didn't play football in middle school, but played basketball in middle school, football in high school. And not once did I ever step in the house. Not once. And like, we really hang out, used to go, and we come back home before, like, before now. But to this day, I still can't remember going in their houses because it was a no-no. And their parents were teachers in our school. It was just very different. So, yeah, that is a lasting impression. Even to this day, as a grown man at 40 years old, I still remember those days and still wonder if people's intentions are really pure about what is it that we can and can't do anymore. Like, how far can these relationships go? And there are some people who jump completely out there and say, you know what, that's not a part of who I am. But when you've been scarred and traumatized with some of these things that you've seen and heard and experienced, some of that stuff you have to show me. And even in showing me once or twice, it still is not a complete erase of the memories that you've had growing up. It's just, it is what it is. So, and I don't like to say that because it happened and you guys have talked about it, we've worked through it, and now I got to give you got to give people a time to work through that. And especially in the world we're living in right now, like, my wife to this day still is fearful when I leave home. To this day, she came in the house last night and I was in the basement working, and she came and she said, just came and gave me a hug and just broke down crying. She's still fearful about these kind of things. When you have sons and you have people that you love very dearly, and you see these kind of things that still happen in 2020. And I still had those images of when I was a little boy in 1985. And they still keep coming back full circle. It's not like things that you can forget. This is like burn into your brain. Like, even if you want to shake away from it, but it's still hard to do it because it's still a reality in the world that we live in. So yeah, that And I'm not more worried about me at this point when it comes to that. I worry about that I'm not going to respond to the people and do the right thing in some situations for my child to see it. And the people that I love and want to set a good example for, because you want to say that won't happen. But it's not true. So you got to make sure you're saying the right things to people and doing the right things, but also equipping yourself to be able to walk through some of the traumatic situation that you witnessed and had nothing to do about. You just saw it.
Well, what you're talking about, of course, is you spoke in terms of a corrective, mm-hmm. but it's also changing the narrative. Mm-hmm. You're in a position now, yeah. Where as much as anybody else in a given community, a high school principal, I mean, a elementary school, middle school, any principal has as much opportunity to change the narrative as anybody. Mm-hmm. I mean, really. Especially for you, and that's where your heart and soul is right now. We've talked about basketball, uh-huh. talked about your growing up years, we talked about your mom, all that. Yeah. But right now, your heart and soul, other than your kids and your wife, is in public education. So, mm-hmm. so let's transition there a little bit.
Yes, sir.
You became a principal at Eisenberg Elementary School back when Windsor Eagle retired as the Salisbury High School principal. He had been there 32 years. Now, yeah. people in this area know who that is.
Yeah.
He was an institution at that place. So when he's retiring, you're starting, which if I'm doing my math correct, back in 2012, that means you've got at least 24 more years at Eisenberg Elementary School. Is that right? To make 32, to break his record of 32 yeah. years. Well, let's imagine, I'm not saying you're going to do that, but let's imagine that you do that. If you were to stay at the helm based on the strengths you bring, your passions for what you want to do, what you want to accomplish, you know that community, that context. What do you hope Eisenberg will look like in 24 years?
Wow. I would hope that what we're building right now, from a global perspective, I would hope that Eisenberg would look like, I don't want to say heaven, but it would look like that. Whereas a place of high levels of learning, we're not doing a lot of, hopefully not a lot of heavy intervention, because the goal is to reach back and get people before they get started. And right now we do a lot of catch-up work, closing a lot of gaps, circling back to make sure people have it, right? Doing full-scale work to make sure families have just basic needs and necessities being met. So I would hope in 24 years that we would have set up precedent or some foundation where then we can start growing and those gaps are closed, and that we could then be the lender rather than the borrower in that situation, right? So we can build and be able to help those other communities, not just in Salisbury, across. I would like for it to be a flagship to say, this is where we started. And because we did this kind of work the right way, now I can show you anywhere in the world that you can do this and change the narrative and also change lives and communities by just focusing on these three or four different principles. And if we can do that and keep growing, because you and I both know this and everybody knows this, if you got to keep starting over every year, you can't grow the way you should. But if we keep setting those good foundational skills and then we can really get some really good roots in the ground, hopefully this tree that we planted right now, a little seed and growing up and sprouting and getting some little flowers and buds on it. But hopefully in 24 years, it will have a really thick trunk and big branch and leaves and blossoming. And it'll be something that people can come and marvel at and say, you know what? This is what it should be. Like this is really what a tree of life and education and those things brings a lot of life to people. Like this is what it should look like. This tree right here helped it start and build and sustain a community. And that's kind of what I would like for it to be. And if I'm not around to do it, I'm hopeful that when I finish doing what I'm doing, whether it's 24 years from now, whether it's 10 years from now, that when I'm finished, that it's better than it was when I got it. So that's kind of what I wanted to be.
That's great. That's awesome. Well, one of those foundational tools you learned from your mama when she said vocabulary is the great equalizer, right?
Yeah.
I love that phrase, by the way, and that is so yeah. true. But we got to know each other through the reading initiative, third grade reading initiative, which is sort of similar. I mean, obviously. And so I want to talk a little bit about that. We use oftentimes this metaphor that you, up until third grade, you're reading, you're learning to read. After third grade, you're reading to learn. So third grade is critical. And we were having a lot of challenges at, in lots of schools, but including Eisenberg, of getting our third graders up to par. We use, this is an analogy that has been used for us. Well, I don't know if it's an analogy or reality. For several years, and you had mentioned, Marvin, that you had heard this as well, that we use a community's third grade reading statistics to predict the size of that community's prison population as they design literally the size of a prison for a community. Is that a fair or an unfair analogy?
It's a fair one. And again, I like the way you say you don't know whether it's analogy or reality, but it is. It's reality. And what our jobs are to do is to make sure we can be change agents. And you don't become change agents if you're not willing to be courageous enough to go in and ask questions and then put some work to those questions once the answers are given to you. So I would say that's probably one of the best things that's happened to us since I've been at Eisenberg. We've always had a very strong faith-based volunteer community, and with a couple other churches, First United, you guys, Soldiers Memorial. But it wasn't until we started putting some frameworks in place to address specific needs for the kids in our community. And I would say people don't realize the time you waste when you're not specific in the things you ask for and also the things that you do. Right? Let me give you an analogy. Some people can say, I'm hungry. Right? And I was always told, don't ever go to the grocery store when you're hungry, because you end up buying a lot of stuff you don't need. Right?
Right.
Yes?
Right.
But a lot of times when you see the need of something, like reading, you just start asking people, come in and be a part of something. Come and help me read, do this. But until you design a program or a framework that says, what about reading that our kids not do well? And you're specific about that. And is it reading? Is it relationships that they don't have? Is it phonics? Is it writing? Is it vocabulary? Is it putting a subject and a verb together and then letting them know that these are two of the same things that you can work on to build onto what you already know? Like, are you able to do it? If you're not willing to ask those specific questions and then put something in place around it, then you can say you're hungry, but you really are wasting people's money and your time, right? So what I get is this program that we did, it was a lot of time and thought put into it. And it was a lot of questions and meetings around, is this working right? Do we need to add something different? Is it the right grade level? So, but until you really are looking at a thing and saying, you know what, I'm not gonna stop until this is right. I'm not gonna stop until this is right. Let's get it right. And I think in areas like ours, where you have so many different issues, and some of it may very well come from reading, but if you're not willing to put the time in and to stick to it, and this to say, I'm going to stay right here until we get it right. And then when we get it right, I'm going to see what I can to make it better. And then when it's better, make sure it's the best. And then see, can we now replicate that to fix the masses? So we have to continue to do this kind of work, because again, some people say, well, we don't have time to do it that way. Well, you really don't have time not to do it that way, because the kids that you're gambling on right now, they have a place for them. They're building it right now. They are building it right now. So if you don't are not serious about it, and I say this, I sometimes rub people the wrong way. If you're in a high need school and you're not working with your community, they need to get out of that school. You're not courageous enough to me. You cannot do this stuff by yourself. No way can you do it by yourself. So I would say to people, do what you know is right and stay on top of it. Because again, it makes no sense to do it if you're not going to do it right.
Yeah, that's great. And you're right. That's a courageous statement for you to make to your colleagues. That's good stuff. So you're investing personally, you're investing a lot of time in this, in lots of things, but this, including this third grade reading initiative, is it working?
Yes, sir. So over the past 5 years, and I believe this initiative started 5 years ago, I believe, we have met or exceeded growth 5 straight years in our building. And we started out with third grade, and then I think 2 years after that, we moved it down to second grade to start pick some of those kids up. And I will say, man, and I just can't say enough, and I know you probably don't want me to say this, but the help that you get, it's always good to get good help and make sure the people that's giving you those resources are bought into what you're doing. And at your church, you have bought into the program. It's hard for a person that's working in your building or in your church to say, I don't know if I have time to do that when the actual preacher is doing it, right? And doing it at a high level and doing it with a smile. Like, when you ask people for things, if it works better when your best people or the people who are at the top of that ladder are doing what you're asking everybody else to do. Like, I play sports forever in the day. And when I play basketball, my coach used to tell me, if Marvin is doing it and he's our best player, there's no conversation about it. When I was coaching, I would say the same thing to her. If your best player or your most important player is your hardest worker or the one that's most available, you're going to win. But when it splinters the other way, it's harder. So I am more than appreciative of the sacrifices that have been made from my community partners and the resources that have been given, but not only the physical and the monetary things, but the time that has been put into plan and also make it come to actualization. And then the time to sit back and say, to come back and meet again and say, how is this working? Like, all those things matter. The planning of it, the actual implementation of it, and then also the assessment to see how is it working. And then to see if we can revamp it and do it again. And that's a model in any area. If you're doing those things right at a high level, you're going to get some good results. And I'm ecstatic about our results, not only data-wise, but I love to see the relationships with our kids. Let me tell you why. And if I can indulge you just for a second, a lot of the kids that work in my school that are in my building that look like me don't see guys that look like you, and they don't even know your title. Like, you're a big deal in the area. They don't have a clue as to how big your church is or how many hands that you touch in the community. They have no earthly idea. What they see is a man that doesn't look like me that's going to come in here. He's smiling when he comes in. He's working with me. And that helps to break down some of those other walls that I talked about earlier in my situation. I never had, until I got to be in high school or middle school, it was always a coach. There was nobody else that ever came there academically and said, you know what, you got a shot to do this well, right? And if it was somebody that looked like me. It was never somebody on the other side. So it breaks down those trust issues that kids normally, or those barriers that kids normally are growing up with, that they, I don't know if I can trust him. Because if the first time you talk to me was when I'm a high school junior or senior, I'm already almost grown then. I don't know if I want to talk to you this point. I got the choice to not say so. Pastor Tim Bates said this to me one day, and it was, I think I may have shared this with you. And he said to me before, he said, one of the worst things that we've ever done was to take men and introduce them to boys when they're in high school and middle school. Because at that point, they have a choice to say no. We got to get them before that. Because a lot of the kids in my area have beautiful moms, have grandparents that love them, but a lot of times those father figures aren't there. So when a man speaks to a boy, boys automatically are set a lot of times to say, we're built to be combative at times, like, because we are normally the hunters and the gatherers. So we have a different layer to us. So at the first time you speak to me is when I'm at the point where I can go hunt and gather for myself. I have the choice then to say, I don't know if I want to deal with you at this point. But if I can get to you earlier, before those things have really started to take root, then I can break some of those other barriers down. So I think it's very important. I think for the work that you guys have done in our building with this program, it's some of the best stuff I've seen. And I think not only does it bless us, it really does help the men in your community and the women in your community who come and to help us as well. It's a wonderful thing. I would think, again, if you're a high need school and you're not doing something like this, I don't know how you're doing it. Yeah, you got to be courageous enough to say, we got to do this better.
That's great. I'm going to push you one step further. Marvin. We've been watching The Last Dance. Have you been watching The Last Dance on TV? tells the story of the Chicago Bulls last season. But also, you're reminded of how intense of a competitor Michael Jordan was.
Yeah.
I mean, incredible, and is to this day, I'm sure. So you are an intense competitor. You always have been.
Yeah.
And I know that your heart and soul is to be the best that you can be personally, but also for your school to be the best that it can be. So you have a chance. Let's pretend you have a chance right now. Mm-hmm. Maybe they're listening to this podcast. Carl Ford, Harry Warren, they're our state representatives, legislators, our senator. If they were to listen to this podcast, what's one piece of advice that you would give them as they consider priorities for this coming year, priorities that you hope will make your school and our schools the best they can be? What's one piece of advice you'd give them?
So I'm glad you asked that question. I'm glad you did a segue with Michael Jordan, The Last Dance. Because the first thing I would say to them is they need to approach this situation, the next 20 years of education, as if next year is the last dance. Because you don't know what pandemics are coming. Yeah. And what happened this year on March 17th when we had to leave school and do things, everything we do educationally, business models, things that have to change. Not just change, but you have to change and think, what can I do to make sure if this happens again, that we're ready for it? Because we can ill afford in some of our schools like ours to have kids to be without strong education 8, 9, 10 weeks at a time. You can't do it. Now, our county was ready for it, but there are some other counties that were nowhere near ready for what we did this year, right? So what I'm saying, they need to prepare as if this really is the last dance, because again, they don't know if it's not. So making sure our teachers are duly compensated and done the right things as it pertains to resources and onboarding and giving people the right resources to be successful for kids. The next thing I will say to them is they need to help to rewrite the narrative about education and to be courageous about that. Like, if you know there are people who are educators right now who are saying, I will not send my daughter or son to school to be an educator. That's a problem. Because you don't have very many doctors or lawyers or preachers or any other profession that's saying that's a good profession and I love what I'm doing, but you will not, I won't send my son or daughter to do it. Because the narrative is so, has drugged the name of teachers through the mud for so long. Like, I know for a fact what we do is great work. We know that teachers are the foundation of every profession. But if you are in the position to make those things happen for those people to be teachers, not only do you want to sustain them, but we also want to be recruiting better teachers. And you're not going to recruit this generation of kid to come and do something if you're not saying all the right things. Like, there needs to be something said about the work that's happening and that they're going to be taken care of fiscally and also that they can create a legacy outside of what this is. Like, we have to do better about that, because again, the narrative about being a teacher, it's a joke. And the people that are in those positions have got to help to rewrite that. Teachers should be the last people that we have to worry about taking care of. They should be first. And if you're in that position, you got to be courageous enough to jump up and say it, not just for political reasons, but just to do it. You got to say and do and put some action behind those words. Because again, we're not going to recruit and retain this new generation of thinkers with 80 salaries that people are being asked to receive, be the work that they got to get done. And some of these areas, the onboarding that they have to do in order just to get ready for it. And some of the colleges, I mean, I know of colleges that are private and kids are doing 30 year loans. I mean, they can't pay for the stuff because of the profession that they're in. So why would I go and pay to make $40,000 a year, $50,000 a year after 30 years? So that is that we have to change that. So, and it's an honorable profession. And if we don't do the right thing at this point and draw a line in the sand and say, this might be the last dance for this. It may be the last dance if we don't address it the right way. So I think those guys are phenomenal guys. I met both of them before. But it has to be a different way of thinking as we move forward. Because if not, this may be our last chance to recruit and retain some of the best teachers potentially that's coming in to our system.
That's great. That's terrific. Well, there's no doubt in the world that leaders change the narrative, leaders change the culture, and you're one of those leaders, Marvin. Thank you for being that. Thanks for being such an important part of our community's story. God is using you in very powerful ways in your family, in your school, in public education. So we're very thankful that you've accepted that call. It's been great to have the conversation with you. I know folks will be energized by your enthusiasm, and they'll be thankful too, just like I am, that you are where you are. So keep on keeping on. Until next time, just be the light.
Hey, all right. Thank you so much, sir. Godspeed in everything you continue to do.
Yeah. Yeah, you too. Thanks, Marvin. Take it easy.
All right.